It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Blake Gardner is with us today. He has enjoyed an amazing life in basketball and is still active today. He is a member of the Kentucky Sports Hall of Fame, a member of the Kentucky High School Athletic Association Hall of Fame. He coached Fairdale High School to the 1994 Boys State Championship, and he continues to coordinate the King of the Bluegrass Tournament, one of the leading high school tournaments in the country since he organized it at first in 1981. Before all that, he was the trainer, equipment manager, and traveling secretary of the Kentucky Colonels, who won the ABA championship 50 years ago, May of 1975. He is the author, along with Gary West, of the book Kentucky Colonels of the American Basketball Association, The Real Story of a Team Left Behind, and also the book Shots from the Sidelines, about 500 photos of the Colonels, and he wrote the captions for all of those, providing memories for Kentucky Colonels fans. Now, he has the firsthand memories and also the memorabilia from the Colonels, who played only one more season after that championship year. Lloyd, it's great to have you with us, and thanks for doing this today.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on, and it's always great talking about the history of sports in Kentucky, particularly basketball. I think it's every coach's dream to win the state championship in basketball in Kentucky, because it is the king of the state. And I was so blessed to be on an assistant coach on two teams with Stanley Hardin, and back to back in 1991. And then Stanley went on to South Carolina as assistant, and I took over and was fortunate enough to have enough great athletes in 1994 to win the state championship the last time anybody won it in Freedom Hall.
That's right. That was the last one played at Freedom Hall. You had a great game against Dunbar in the championship game, and a memorable game to be sure. And like you say, that's a treasured memory for any coach who takes his team to the Boys State High School Championship in Kentucky. It's still a special event after all these many years.
Well, it was very, very special. And you know, Keith, from doing so many state tournaments, that nobody wanted to ever play Bobby Keith.
Mm-hmm.
We drew Clay County the very first game, and it happened to be the year that Bobby Keith announced his retirement.
Uh-oh.
I said, my gosh, what have I got myself into? But Bobby and I were very, very good friends. We talked before the game, and we embraced and hugged and shook hands at half court before the game, and we both said, we'll meet you right here, win or lose, after the game, Bobby. Good luck, and let's have a great game tonight. So we started out with a big, big win against the coach who, I guess, was loved by more people in Kentucky than anybody else if your team wasn't playing.
Well, he was very, very well respected and highly regarded, and had just incredible success there at Clay County. And I guess, let's see, it's now been 31 years since that championship for you. Have you gotten together with those guys? Do you have occasions where you get together on the anniversary years?
Yeah, first of all three of our state championship teams, we have a group text where we keep in touch. Some things have been going on with one of our players from the 1991 team, Maurice Morris. Physically, he's doing fine now, but we text each other almost on the hour. How are things going? It's a continuous texting, at least once or twice a month, that we all text, a group text. So how you doing? Where are you? What's going on? So we also have one for my 94 team, and we stay in touch. The last time we got together as a team was at the state tournament when they recognized our 25-year state championship. But Eric Martin's been overseas. He just got back home, and we're going to have lunch together next week when he gets settled in. And, of course, Rayshon Morris is here in town, and I always call those guys, says, if you want to have lunch, come on. Lunch is on me. We'll sit around and talk about our state championship in 94.
Well, that's a bond that lasts forever when you win a championship, and that certainly applies to that great Colonels team of 1974-75. And you mentioned to me that you still talk regularly with Hubie Brown, who recently stepped down from his position as a commentator on NBA games. He was the coach of that Colonels championship game in 1975, one of the great figures in basketball, and you said you talked to him just before that we connected here this afternoon.
Yes, I did. Matter of fact, I got off the phone. I'm going to call him back whenever we're finished. He lives alone now. He's in Atlanta, and he has some health issues, but he's doing much better. He has a physical therapist trainer and a physical fitness trainer that's really been helping him get in the pool and do some exercise. It's helping with his balance, so I was really glad to hear that today. But I worked for all seven coaches and with the Kentucky Colonels, plus I was with Mr. Diddle and Johnny Oldham, two great coaches. But for the seven pro coaches I worked for, Hubie knew more than all of them. So I give a lot of my success to Hubie and the people that I was around. Even Mike Storen, who was a general manager, taught us the business of basketball. It's been so valuable in running the King of Bluegrass and in being able to do the things that are not X's and O's to make that successful over the years. And you surround yourself with good people and you try to learn from them. And we all stand on the shoulders of other keys. None of us got where we are today because of everything that we knew. We got it from somebody else or somebody helped us. So if you have a great network of people around you, you have a great chance of being successful no matter what endeavor you choose to go.
Yeah, it always is crucial to have great teammates, whether it's actual teammates that you play with or teammates that support you or help you or lead you throughout life. And I know you've had a lot of those as you've gone down the path of your career. The ABA was such an interesting era in basketball, 1967 to 76. And tell me how you got involved with the Colonels in the early part of that period.
Well, if there are any young people listening, and I talked to a basketball camp last week, in 1958, Fairdale High School, they hired Forrest Abel as their head coach. Forrest Abel took Fairdale High School to the state tournament in 1952. Then he went on to University of Louisville, and then he went, his girlfriend was down at Western, so he transferred to Western. So he started against Western for U of L. 2 years later, he started against U of L for Western. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he went to Western Kentucky, one of their great, great teams. They were top 10 teams every year. He got drafted when there were 9 teams in the NBA. You talk to kids today, there's 30 teams. When you get drafted, there are only 9 teams. That's pretty remarkable. So he didn't play a lot, but he did get drafted. He was the same year that Bill Russell was the number one draft pick. But anyway, now he's back at Fairdale, the head basketball coach, and I tried out for basketball. We only had 7, 8, 9. We added a year each year till I graduated. In the 9th grade, he cut me from the team, and I was heartbroken. And he said, "Lloyd, if you'll be my manager, they're starting this thing called trainers these days. No such thing as trainers, but Kramer's, the sports medicine people that furnished all the supplies back then, from tape to Kramer Jezik, all these different types of things they use on athletes. They put out a student trainer that sent you a pamphlet every 2 weeks. And I had a notebook with all those in it and studied them. And he said, if you'll stick with me, I'll get you with Mr. Diddle at Western Kentucky when you graduate." I graduated Fairdale in 1962, and I moved in with Mr. Diddle in September of 62 and stayed there until 1967 when I graduated. Took Mr. Diddle about every place he went. They were building Diddle Arena. I actually drove him in Diddle Arena when there wasn't a roof on it. He'd say, "Manager, take me in to drive me in there." I said, "Mr. Diddle, there's got steel hanging up there." He said, "It's my building. Drive me in there." So a lot of great Ed Diddle stories, and then Johnny Oldham took over, and Gene Rhodes was the assistant coach for Johnny Oldham, and I'm about a week from graduation, and Gene Rhodes calls me in and said, "Lloyd, they're going to start a pro basketball team in Louisville. Would you be my trainer? I said, Gene, I'd love to be. Well, I set up the first rookie camp. Next thing I know, a guy named Johnny Givens comes in. He's the head coach. Gene Rhodes wanted their money in escrow, and they didn't put it in escrow, so he decided not to coach the Colonels. So Johnny Givens didn't want a trainer. He wanted an assistant coach. So we hired his roommate in college, Buddy Keats. And so I'm out of a job, but I continued working for nothing. I got a job teaching school, and back in those days, you didn't travel a trainer. They didn't have the money. So I would tape one team and then come over and tape the Kentucky Colonels. So I worked all the home games and a few practices. Well, the next year, 16 games in the very first season, they fired Johnny Givens. And Gene Rhodes did come back, so it made me even happier that I could still work with Gene. And matter of fact, I would sell, the players got two tickets apiece, and any of them that were left over, I would go out on the street and sell them for $2, uh-huh. Give me a little pocket change. But anyway, then Gene asked me to set up camp the next year, and I did. I worked camp, and I had a son, and I ran into some difficulties with that, not health-wise, but I had to get out of it and stay in teaching. So I was a teacher, and then in early 1971, Gene hired his trainer from St. X named Bill Antonini. And so Bill was a big Gene Rhodes advocate, which I was, but they brought in Frank Ramsey to coach, and they didn't get along at all. So they're coming home from a road trip. Billy gets drunk, goes straight to the courier, blasts Frank Ramsey. And the next day they come to my classroom and say, Lloyd, a guy named Alex Groza wants you to call him. I go to the office and he says, Lloyd, he said, Bill Antonini quit the team. He said, we need a trainer and people to tape ankles till we can hire somebody. He said, can you come to practice tonight at Freedom Hall at 3:00? I said, sure, it's right after school. So I go to Freedom Hall. After practice, Mike Storen comes in, runs me out of the locker room and says, we're going to have a meeting. He goes in the meeting and he says, who is the player who would not give his name and made a comment about Frank in the paper? Well, they were in there for 2 hours, and Mike says, we're not leaving until somebody says we're going to. Who said it? Finally, Louis Dampier stood up and said, I said it, Mike. He said, I'm sorry I shouldn't have said it. Well, it wasn't Louis. He just said, I want to get the heck out of this meeting. So I stayed on and helped them. I was going to miss. They only had 9 road games left. Had a lot of home games, but only 9 road games. So Charlie Reuter was our scorekeeper. He was the chairman of the Board of Education. He said, Lloyd, you need to write a letter to the board just requesting to be off those days to travel. So I did that. They approved it. Well, guess what? We went to the 7th game of the championship that year. We got beat by Utah and Utah on game 7 in the ABA championship. So I missed I had 30-some games. And after the season, Mike Storen called me in and said, Lloyd, I'd like to hire you full-time. Would you like to do it? Well, I was making $54.50 was my salary at Fairdale, and he was going to pay me $7,500. So I switched jobs. So, it was a great move. It was a great life, and I was so blessed to do it. And actually, that very first summer in '71, Mike called me in, and his trainer Mike had been the general manager with the Indiana Pacers when they were so successful and won championships. And our ownership here in Louisville, which happened to be John Y. Brown, mm-hmm. Wendell Cherry, David Grissom, David Jones, and a guy named Stuart Jay, they owned the team, and they hired Mike Storen. And when Mike came in, he called me in right after the season. He says, Lloyd, my trainer at Indiana is named Bernie LaRue. He's now the head trainer with Chicago Bears. I want you to go up and work for the Chicago Bears this summer for 3 weeks. So I went up to Rensselaer, Indiana, and worked for the Bears and worked on Gale Sayers and Butkus Knees. Yeah. After we taped 100 guys, we had to tape 100 guys twice a day.
A lot of personnel there in football, yeah.
Yeah, I've had some great experiences. Yeah. I've been so blessed throughout my life. I've lived every dream a young kid could ever have that didn't have the athletic ability to play a lot of sports. Although I played football at Fairdale, we were runner-up in the state to Flash A when they had Rick Norton. So,
sure. Yeah, I wanted to ask you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about one of the duties that you had. You had multiple duties. Was as the traveling secretary, and I'm picturing a traveling secretary in the ABA or really anywhere in professional sports. That's a wide range of duties, and somebody who has to really be able to adjust on the fly. You start with a plan, but always have to be ready for changes. And also, in those days, there were at least a couple of ABA franchises that were maybe not as solid as the Colonels were in terms of fan base and places to play. What was that traveling secretary experience like for you?
Well, I got the schedule in August, and I sat down with a guy named Tommy Bacon from Eastern Airlines. We sat down, and you had what's called an air travel guide. It was about the size of a phone book.
Big, thick book.
And you would look in there. Let's say you're going to Salt Lake City. You try to find the cheapest, the quickest, the best flights you could get from Louisville, Chicago to Salt Lake City. You made the reservation. Then you got to get from Salt Lake City, maybe to San Diego or wherever. And it took a couple of days to do it, but within 2 days, I had every flight booked for the whole season. And then I took care of all the meals, all the per diem. Well, I didn't take care of meals because everybody got per diem. They ate on their own. I had all the hotel reservations made. We played 42 games on the road before the playoffs. We played like 6 exhibition games. I had buses, ground transportation, picking us up at the airport, sometimes a bus, sometimes a cab. Actually, the trainer and travel secretary, they were in charge of the team from the time practice was over. Let's say we practiced Freedom Hall, practice over usually at 1 o'clock. The trainer's in charge till the coach walks in the locker room before the game to give the game plan. And after the game, the trainer, again, he's in charge. You get everybody up, a wake-up call in the morning because we were flying coach back then. Of course, today they fly in a private plane. They get $125 a day per diem. They don't carry their bags. They all sleep in a single room. Well, back then, it's two to a room. You traveled coach. But I had what's called a group ticket. And we usually traveled 15 people, so I'd put 13 people on the group ticket. And then I get a single ticket for me and a single ticket for Van Vance, our radio man.
Yes.
Because if somebody got sick or traded, you could just turn that ticket in and send them to the next place, which you certainly couldn't do today. But that was quite a job, plus taking care of all the equipment and all the injuries as an athletic trainer.
Now, when I see names like the Pittsburgh Condors and the Floridians, were any of those stops maybe a little bit unusual because of the nature of the business as to how those franchises operated as opposed to maybe how the Colonels operated, or was there much difference?
Well, I will say this. The Kentucky Colonels operated 100% first class. The franchises that were really scary were the Virginia Squires. They had several ownerships and the Memphis, they were the Memphis Pros, the Memphis Tams. And when it's the Memphis Tams, Charlie O'Finley,
yes. Only
Oakland A's was the owner. And then Mike Stornbottom, they were the Memphis Sounds. And they were on shaky grounds a lot. In the later years, even Utah, as great as they were, they had a great team with Moses Malone and Ron Boone. And they had won the championship in 71. They ended up getting shaky, but the Carolina Cougars had a great team with Billy Cunningham. They were huge in the ABA, and they moved to St. Louis where they had Marvin Barnes and Caldwell Jones and Maurice Lucas and a lot of the Indiana Pacers. Moses Malone even ended up there, but there was a lot of moving around, and you would hear guys Virginia saying, well, I don't know if I'll get a paycheck next week. They would talk to our guys after the game, and as far as the Colonels, we were never really threatened to not get a paycheck or not be treated with first class because Mike Storm was certainly a first class person. And I don't know if you know it, Keith, but Hannah Storm, who's on ESPN, is Mike Storm's daughter. She was about 3 years old when they lived here. So there is a connection. Her dad's the person that hired me.
You mentioned some of the names of the players around the league, and it became apparent that these were guys who could play at the NBA level as well, and that a lot of these players certainly could be stars in the NBA. And of course, the year the Colonels won, the co-MVPs, am I correct here, Julius Erving and George McGinnis. And then, of course, Hubie Brown coached in the league, and Kevin Lockery was with the New York Nets, Al Bianchi with the Virginia Squires, and Tom Nasalki with San Antonio, and of course, mentioning Hubie Brown with the Colonels. So there was a lot of coaching talent as well. This was a league that, even though some teams might have difficulties with the business side of it, there was always a lot of talent, wasn't there?
Well, there's not any question. Matter of fact, the very first year of the merger, the ABA folded on June 16th, 1976, and it took about 15 minutes to fold the league. And but the very next year, the NBA All-Star Game, the first year after the merger, of the 24 players, 10 of them were ABA guys that came right out of the ABA, because the talent was just as equal. We had fewer teams, but the talent was much better. And Hubie Brown will tell you to this day that the Kentucky Colonels could have won the championship in the NBA maybe for a couple of years had we not traded Dan Issel. Now, our ownership, John Y. Brown owned the team, and Ellie Brown owned the team. And they took it over in 74, 75 when they hired Hubie, actually 73, 74. And they challenged the Golden State Warriors, who had won the NBA championship in 75. $1 million winner take all. And the commissioner refused to let them play us. It probably would have been at Caesar's Palace, because Lums was one of the things that John Y. Brown owned, and they were part owner of Caesar's Palace. Okay. And it might have been out there, because they wanted to put it on. But there was a $1 million put up, winner take all. And John Y. Brown told the commissioner and Frank Maliath of the Golden State Warriors, if you don't play us, we're putting world championships on our championship ring. And I have mine on my hand right now, and it says World Champion Kentucky Colonels, 1975. Yeah. Well, we played them in October, an exhibition, and beat them, and we didn't get a single penny.
Yeah, no return on the exhibition game, but I'm sure everybody remembers the result, though. You mentioned the name of Dan Issel, and of course, that's who you start with when you talk about the Colonel players, and he was so instrumental to the rise of the Colonels and the ABA. Tell me about what he meant to the team.
Well, actually, Mike Storen took over. The first thing he did was he drafted Dan Issel. Like, he was actually supposed to go to Texas. And Dan said, I will not go to Texas. So Mike Storen got the league to agree that if he could sign him in Kentucky, could they sign him? So that was the only place Dan would go. So Dan's first year in the league, that's the year that we go to the seventh game against Utah. Dan was our center. Well, the next year, the owners put in an envelope how much they would pay Artis Gilmore, the 7-foot-2 center out of Jacksonville, who absolutely dominated basketball back then. And the Kentucky Colonels had the highest bid. They signed Artis Gilmore. He become the center. Dan become the small forward, the big forward, the power forward. So we had a great front line. And we're so it wasn't until 75, 76 we brought in Will Jones, Marv Roberts. Of course, we already had Louis Dampier. Of course, off that team, Dampier, Gilmore, and Issel, and Hubie are all in the Naismith Hall of Fame. But in 74, 75, we had Bird Averett. Hubie Brown played 10 players every single game, a player at a time that he got up off the bench. He checked himself in, and it wouldn't be a complete rotation. It might be two guys would go in, a forward, and a guard would go in. And then a few minutes later, those two would come out, the two on the bench would go back in, but they were staggered, where there were always three starters on the floor. And I know that Ron Thomas went in, even at 6'6", could hold his own at center. He went in for Artis Gilmore at the 2-minute mark of every quarter except the fourth. And if we were had a sizable lead or a comfortable lead. He even went in for Artis for a break sometime during the fourth quarter.
Yeah, I was looking, I have the roster here in front of me, that 74-75 team. You mentioned several of the players and talked about them. And, of course, Louis Dampier was a great at Kentucky. Bert Averett from Kentucky played at Pepperdine, was from is Hopkinsville, is that right?
Yeah. Hopkinsville High School, yes.
Yeah, and Ted McLean, Ted the Hound McLean, who played at Tennessee State. I got to see him play against Kentucky State in a game back in the early 70s, and he was called the Hound because he was such a great defensive player, but he was quite a player, wasn't he?
Oh, he was quite a player, and he proved that crime does play on the basketball floor because he set the record for steals in the playoffs against the Indiana Pacers in 75 when we won the championship. So Bird Averett was a unique person. I absolutely loved Bird. They called him Bird because his chest wasn't any bigger than a bird's chest. He's not a big guy, but he's quick as lightning. Always laughing, loved to play the game. And actually, you know, you put a towel on the floor for him to wipe his feet on to get some traction. Well, I had to have another towel because Bird, he'd be playing so hard, he would run down the floor, throw up on the towel, and go right back out on the floor and just keep going. So he was a very unique person. Unfortunately, he was in a car wreck, and then he had a stroke on top of that, and we lost him about 5 years ago. But one of my favorite people of all times. And actually, Marv Roberts could have been the MVP of the championship. One of the unique things, you think about guys today, Artis Gilmore had 41 points and 28 rebounds in game three, and he had 28 points and 31 rebounds in the championship game.
That's amazing, yeah.
And one night in New York, he broke the ABA record with 40 rebounds against the Nets. But he was and they're great, great people. I cannot say one single bad word about Dan, Artis, Louis, or a single guy on that basketball team. And when you have your three best players, your best people, that really does make your team, that leadership that you get from those people really make things much better. But the key was Hubie Brown coming in, and his system was 100% no nonsense. But he broke the game down into the smallest of smallest pieces. He was the first coach to ever record second shots. And one of the first things he did when he came here, he said, Lloyd, I want you to put up on the board second shots, first half, second half, total. Underneath that, fast break points. How many fast breaks did you take? How many did you get? How many points did you get? How many did you get for the total game? He was the first to do that. So he broke the game down into very, very small pieces. And I learned so, so much of the little things that most coaches never even think about to teach, and had so much to do with my success as a basketball coach.
Well, the Colonels enjoyed a great atmosphere at Freedom Hall when they played there. They also played a few games here in Lexington at Memorial Coliseum. I got to see the Colonels play at Memorial Coliseum. So things seemed to be rolling there at that point, where you're getting good crowds at Freedom Hall all the time, and then also drawing interest from around the state. The Colonels really were a very, very popular team in that era.
Well, they were a very, very popular team. The big problem was, there were 26 teams at the time, and only two of them were making money. And that was the Milwaukee Bucks, because they just won the world championship with Kareem. They had Oscar Robertson, that great team. And then the Los Angeles Lakers, of course, they had Elgin Baylor, Jerry West, and Wilt Chamberlain. So out of 26 teams, those were the only two making any money. And the reason that the ABA didn't get the recognition it should have was the fact that we didn't have a national television contract. And there were a number of games, NBA, ABA exhibitions, and believe me, the NBA played hard. They weren't exhibitions, they were games, because they did not want to lose to an ABA team. And the ABA held a sizable margin of victories over the NBA teams. And it's one of the reasons that they really forced the merger.
I was going to ask you about the ending of it all. The Colonels only played one more season after the championship year. How, from your perspective, how did things come to an end there after that 75-76 season?
Well, it was very, very unfair. First of all, the Kentucky Colonels, as we won the championship, John Y. Brown decided he's going to trade Dan or Artis. And Dan had just built a brand new home here in Louisville, a huge, beautiful home here in Louisville, and had just moved into it. And we had a big party out there, home warming. And next thing you know, he trades Dan Issel in the middle of the summer. Matter of fact, Dan was on a tour, I think he was in Japan when he got traded. And it was the first year of busing, which wasn't a good thing. And the people just started canceling their season tickets one right after another. So financially, it really caused us to take a hit. And we would have taken the same hit had we gotten rid of Artis, but things went down. But the real key to the ABA folding was for everybody in the ABA ownership signed a paper that they would not go out on their own and deal with an NBA merger. Well, those four teams did: San Antonio, Denver, Indiana Pacers, and the New York Nets. So the Colonels got left out. And so the next thing you know, the team folded. Matter of fact, there's going to be a documentary coming out. It premiered in Indiana this week, and I actually had a event here in Louisville at the request of the producer in Indiana. We had it down at the Slugger Museum, had about 50 people. It's called The Waiting Game. And it just startled me because I thought I knew most of the history of the ABA, but it didn't come out till this documentary came out called The Waiting Game. And what happened, a player named Jumbo Eakins, E-A-K-I-N-S, Eakins played for Virginia and then got traded to New York with Dr. J. Well, Jumbo was the president of the Player Association. So during this merger, as we'll call it, they sent Jumbo Eakins and Doc the papers, and they were to read through it. Well, they sent the papers back and requested a few changes. And then they sent it back to them and said, you only have 3 hours to approve it or deny it. Well, Jumbo couldn't get hold of Dr. J. In the documentary, he actually breaks down and almost cries. He said, for 50 years, I've been carrying this burden of how my players in the Player Association, the players got cheated by the NBA. And what had happened, the key to the whole thing, the original copy said there will be a merger. Well, the word merger means you take the players, you take their salaries, you take the league's debts, you take their records, you take their points. Everything they take, it's a total takeover if you have the merger. They took the word merger out and didn't tell them and put the word in there, expansion. That meant they didn't have to take any debt. They didn't have to pay players' pensions, anything. And just a few years ago, 3 years ago, Scott Tarter, who started dropping dimes, and he actually came to Louisville to help pay Ron Thomas's nursing home bill, and Bird was in financial disaster because of an accident, no job. He'd had a stroke. And they started a dropping dime foundation. He went to the hospital to see a guy by the name of Sam Smith, who grew up in Hazard, played high school ball in Hazard, went to Kentucky Wesleyan, won the national championship, and he played for the Colonels for the first couple of years. And he had gone to Indianapolis, and he was in the hospital, and Scott went to see him. He didn't have anything whatsoever when he passed away. Scott took a picture of him laying in the bed in the hospital on his deathbed with a red, white, and blue ball. He put it on Facebook and said, here's one of our players that's not getting anything to help pay. We had people living in cars. We had people on the streets. I'm talking about players now. Mm-hmm. And so that set the fire to three attorneys getting with the NBA and going over that old contract. And that's when they found out they changed the word merger to expansion. And I think a lot of it's out of embarrassment. Well, the NBA gave $12.5 million and the Player Association gave $12.5 million. And to be very honest with you, it should have been 75 to 100 million because of the money they have. They've still cheated them, and it's only been like 5 years. Mm-hmm. The problem is anybody who'd already deceased, their family got nothing. That, like Bert Avery's family got nothing. Ron Thomas's family got nothing. So if you were deceased before this agreement, you got nothing. Yeah, like Dan and Louie, they don't get any ABA pension because they get an MBA pension. Mm-hmm. They didn't get theirs retroactive. So there's still some flaws in it. And it hasn't bailed everybody out. The next thing is, once the player is deceased, his widow no longer gets a pension check. So there are a lot of ways that the NBA really took advantage of the ABA and the merger, and it's not good, and it'll never be good, but it's better than it was.
Yeah, there's a lot of fallout every time a business situation like that comes up, and in this case, the one word made a big difference for many, many years and still is. I was going to ask you about, I mentioned earlier that you have not only the memories, but the memorabilia. You have, to say the least, a good collection of the souvenirs, memorabilia from the Colonels and from the ABA. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, when the ABA folded, the general manager, David Vance, he called everybody in for a meeting, said, everybody come in my office. You don't need pencil, paper, or anything. We walked in the office, and he basically said, everybody get your coats, hats, personal belongings, go home. The ABA folded 15 minutes ago. Lloyd, go see John Y. Brown. Well, John Y. Brown used to come in the locker room, and he'd say, Pink, if you ever quit with the Colonels, I want you to go to work for me. Well, Starling, he kept his word, so he was going to keep me. And so I went out to his office, met him. And funny, he made me the captain of his boat the first thing. He bought this huge boat. I had an 18-foot runabout. I come to find out he bought a boat, had three Caterpillar engines in it. It was like 80 feet long. But I took care of it all summer. But anyway, I'd go by the colonel's office every day, pick up the mail, take them out to his secretary, Barbara Hildebrand, so she could pay the bills. And I'm sort of making sure that this gets... So I ended up taking all the pictures out of the public relations guy's office, putting them in a box, bringing them home. And then I get a call from Freedom Hall, Lloyd, you need to get the equipment room empty, or we're going to throw it all in the garbage. There's no such thing as a dumpster back then. We had a colonel's van that I used because, if you remember, we played a few games in Cincinnati. We played in Lexington. Of course, we practiced in Freedom Hall and down at U of L Crawford Gym when we couldn't get Freedom Hall. So I had a van to carry equipment in. So I had that van. So I went to Freedom Hall. I packed up every single thing that was in there and took it to my dad's, took it home, put it in my dad's barn. He had a huge barn. Everything was in a trunk. And that was 1976. I didn't realize till 1998 it's worth anything. So I gave uniforms away. I had about 12 basketballs. My kids ruined two basketballs in the driveway before I realized it's worth $2,500. Yeah. Ellie Brown called and wanted some basketballs, and I would give friends basketballs. But anyway, then I gave jerseys to certain people that really liked people, and some of people on Ellie's board I gave jerseys that liked. One of them really liked Wendell Ladner, so I gave her one of Ladner's jerseys. But I kept this stuff, and the guy one time said, Lloyd, that stuff's worth money. I said, what? So I ended up, like, I sold an Issel jersey, Keith, for $320 in 1998. About 10 years ago, it brought $58,800 at auction.
Wow. Oh, my goodness.
So I kept some Issel, Gilmore, and Dampier stuff. I've got the three jerseys that they wore in the championship game. I've got the road jerseys. I have one of every color. I have Cotton Nash's jersey that Dan wore in exhibition, number 44. Uh-huh. It was green and black. That was the original colors when the Gregorys owned the team. So the Fraser Museum was doing famous things in Kentucky. Tory Merton's boat that she sailed across the ocean in, Corvette down there in the museum, but stuff from Betty Crocker, from Daniel Boone, from magicians out in California, from boxers, sports. It's not just sports stuff. So they said, Lloyd, could we borrow your stuff? This was the year before COVID. We're going to do a Made in Kentucky thing in the museum. Well, that was the year before COVID, and now we're in the sixth year of it. I've signed a new two-year contract. They put the uniforms on mannequins. They made a beautiful jump circle with ABA balls, his Kentucky Colonels, and they have all these uniforms on mannequins. The scorebook is down there in a case opened up to the championship game. I have almost all the scorebooks. The game ball is down there. I did get Ellie's trophy. I borrowed it from her. They asked me if I could get it. She graciously would loan it to me anytime I wanted it. Matter of fact, when I had book signings, she said, Lloyd, why don't you come by and get the trophy, because I put some uniforms and things out for exhibition there. Benches from the locker room are down there. Just a lot of different things. The original license from the ABA when it was first formed is down there with the seal on it. So I've got some really nice stuff, and I guess I was just smart enough not to throw it away. Still kind of a pack rat.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a good thing. Basketball fans will appreciate that. Tell me the location again. I mean, is that public, available to public?
It's open to the public. It's Fraser Museum. Okay. It's almost directly across from Hillrich and Bradsby, the Bat Factory. You see big bat?
Mm-hmm.
You're almost right across the street from Fraser Museum. It's right there in the same place. So same area right across the street. So it's a great exhibit. It'll take you a couple hours. You can go in there 5 minutes, 30 minutes, or you can see everything that they've got displayed, made famous in Kentucky. Like I said, Tory Murden's boat's still down there, and a lot of other things.
Just a couple other things here before we wrap up. I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned Ellie Brown, and of course the all female board of directors, the Colonels famously had that for a period of time. Tell me a little bit about that. And also, I had in my Colonels magazine in 73-74, the picture of the all female board of directors, but then later in a listing of the board of directors, there's one male name in there, and it's Adolph Rupp, who I guess was mostly ceremonial, but was appointed a vice chairman of the board. So tell me about the all-female board and also the addition of Coach Rupp to the board.
Well, of course, John White said that Ellie Brown was the president and owner of the team and one of the most beautiful, gracious, unbelievable people, and we were friends till the day they buried her back within the last year. Just a great person, and Ellie said, you know, we're gonna go around this community. She got a bunch of very, very successful business women here in town. They were either part owners of a business, or their husband was a big owner of a business here in town, and they were very active in it. They were in had a lot to do with the Derby festival and different events, and they would have teas, they would have parties, and their primary thing was to sell season tickets and get this town back involved. And with her being a female, it was huge, and a name that you'll remember, but most people won't. Haywood Hale Bruin came to Louisville and interviewed her. Dinah Shore had her on in New York. She went to Toots Shores in New York City for press conferences. Of course, Howard Cosell was one of John Wise's best friends, Jimmy the Greek, and it just opened so many doors by having that all-female board, the national publicity that they got, the national television that they got, And, of course, Adolph Rupp, she put him on the board. And it's funny, we're sitting there on the bench, and Adolph is, like, sitting on the front row directly across from the bench. And we hear the plays kind of slow down, but we hear a great big applause and screaming. And Hubie looks at me and says, Pink, he says, Adolph Rupp's the only guy in the world who can get up, go to the bathroom, get a standing ovation.
Yep, I could imagine that happening. You mentioned there a couple of times that people referred to you as Pink, and that's a nickname you've carried for a long time. And I understand Dan Issel was one of the figures involved in having you get that tag of Pink. Tell me about that, if you would, please.
Well, of course, my name is Lloyd, but Dan used to call me Floyd. Mm-hmm. And he would always tease Wendell Ladner. Dan was a real prankster, and So he called me Floyd. So we get a, we trade Bobby Croft, who you might remember played at Tennessee against Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He played at Tennessee. We traded Bobby Croft to Denver for a guy named Dan Hester, who played at LSU with Pete Maravich. So I'm taping Dan's off ankles, and Dan walks in the locker room for the first practice, and Dan says, "Hey, welcome to the team." And he said, "Hey, Dan, how you doing? Who's this, the trainer?" He said, "This is Floyd." He said, "Oh, Pink Floyd." And from that day on, the word pink has stuck with me, as a, particularly in pro basketball and in sports. It's kind of died down, of course, at the high school level, but still people address me as Pink on the streets. And when I go to different places, I was at an event up with the Pacers about 2 months ago. I got invited up because Bob Costas was a guest speaker, and he invites up. As soon as he walked in, he says, "Hey, Pink, how you doing?" And I set the table with Darnell Hellman, Steve Green, Dave Robey's, all ABA players. And we had a great night up there, but that's how I got the name Pink.
Well, let me wrap up by, first of all, thanking you for doing this, but also to just sum up your lasting impressions of the ABA as we mark 50 years since the Colonels won it all. What are your thoughts about the league and being associated with it?
Well, first of all, I feel very blessed. I remember growing up as a kid, had a black and white TV, and you might usually the only games you would ever get on TV would be the Knicks and the Celtics. And I would see the trainer, one of the only trainers in the NBA back then was Danny Whalen for the Knicks. He always had on his blue top, his white pants, and sitting on the bench. And as a ninth, 10th grader, I dreamed of ever doing that. Thought never, ever, ever thought I would be able to do that. And then the next thing you know, I've been to both Madison Square Gardens, the old and the new, and I've sat on that bench in Madison Square Garden three or four times. We played several games in Madison Square Gardens, particularly exhibition games, maybe a doubleheader. But the ABA was special, and those guys are still to this day very, very tight. In other words, when I'm around the Pacers, they treat me like I was a part of the Pacers, and everything's likewise. The league was very, very close. We were always pulling for each other. They were always trying to get to the next level. And try to make sure that we could hold our own with the NBA. So I was actually offered the job when John Y. traded the Boston Celtics. He traded the Buffalo Braves for the Boston Celtics.
Yeah, the entire franchise, right?
Yeah. Well, Herb Levine owned the Celtics, and he always wanted a team in San Diego. So John Y. traded Buffalo, which you knew he couldn't take Boston out of Buffalo. I mean, out of Boston. Mm-hmm. So he traded Buffalo for Boston. They took Buffalo to San Diego, and that's the Clippers today. Started out the San Diego Clippers. But so John Y. owned the Celtics, and he said, "Lloyd, would you like to be the trainer for the Celtics?" And I said, "John, what are you going to do with my friend Marie Melchiori, your trainer?" He said, "Well, Lloyd, I'll fire him, bring you in." I said, "Well, if you're going to fire my friend, I won't do it." So long story short, I worked for John Y. a couple of things. He treated me great. I wasn't sure what I was going to do. A job came open at Fairdale, and they said, "You want it?" I took it in a hurry, and I never looked back. It's the best thing I've ever done. I've lived a dream both as a pro trainer and travel secretary and all of that. Been on a championship team with the Colonels. Been on three state championships at Fairdale, won my own team. Took three teams to the state tournament. I lived a dream. I worked for the Chicago Bears in the summer and worked on Gale Sayers and Butkus and those guys. And there's not a single thing that I could ever want to do in my life that I haven't been able to do that I dreamed about as a kid.
Well, as I said in the open, it's been an amazing life that is still very much active, and congratulations on all the accomplishments and everything yet to come. And, of course, congratulations on being recognized for all that you've been a part of over the years, and certainly thanks very much for taking time today to talk with us.
Well, I really appreciate it, and it's really great talking to you because that voice brings back a lot of memories because I had the games taped. Matter of fact, I think the best team we played in the state tournament was actually probably Muhlenberg North. although we played Dunbar in the championship, and Coach Watson, great, great people. Of course, both teams were a little tired that night, but your voice on the call of the games back then and today hasn't changed a bit. You all did an awesome job. But I took the tapes and had them made for my championship team. Real quick, I saved all the jerseys from the three state championship teams. 25 years later, I got them all out. I took the jersey that they wore in the championship game. We had them framed, 90-91. Put little markers on which team you were in. Were you on 90-91, just 90-91? I had two kids. It was 91-94. But all three teams got the jersey they played in. Then we gave them the other jersey, the trunks, warm-up, and everything that went with them, because I locked them up and put them away so we could honor those guys. And I also gave them tapes of the championship game and the Muhtemberg North game.
Well, I appreciate that very much. It's great to know that they are looking at our tapes as part of their memories of some really great times in their lives, and appreciate you. And I know they do in supplying all those memories and helping to just keep it all alive as you remember those championship teams and all the great accomplishments through the years in basketball. And again, thanks so much for doing this today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure, and I appreciate all that you're doing, and just keep up the great work. You do an awesome job.
You've been listening to the WUKY Sports Page with your host, Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced at the WUKY studios by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to the Sports Page through iTunes, Google Play, or at our website, wuky.org.